Sure.
Never get my hat straight.
What's a good intro?
Well, just an introduction to this. You know, for me, this is episode one, season two, reformat of the podcast.
Am I launching your second season?
You're launching the second season.
That feels like a lot of pressure.
You are listening to The Troycast on CAP Knowledge Network. Today, Troy is joined by Christy Jones, Manager of Leadership Development for the Meyer Organization. Join them with part one of their conversations about leadership, work-life balance, and European cigarettes. So without delay, here are Troy and Christy.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you happen to be. This is season two, episode one of the new and improved, reformatted, redone, reissued CAP Knowledge Network, now known as the Troycast. We are we're kicking off season two, episode one, with one of the best guests that I can find. She's shaking her head knowingly. Everybody, I want you to welcome Christy Jones to the podcast. Christy, tell us a little bit about what it is you do and the way that you do it. And for those out there who probably don't know you, which based on my my listenership is probably less than three people.
So first off, delighted to be here. And what do I do and how do I do it? So I've been 25 years in all things organizational change, leadership development, change management. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm a seventh grade social studies teacher that got into business along the way. So that includes things like leadership development strategy and programs, executive coaching work, looking at organizational change through the lens of the human experience. So, you know, how do we best show up as leaders to serve those people that are in our span of care versus I'm the boss and this is what you need to do. That's not the mentality or the perspective that I take on either coaching or leadership, because I fundamentally don't think it works. So that's been about, 25 years in training and development, leadership development work. 6 years of that as an entrepreneur running a IT and organizational change, small consultancy, and now working for undoubtedly the best organization, because you can not only ride a pony for a penny, but you can get a fishing license and a gallon of milk and diapers at, well, it used to be 3 o'clock in the morning, but you know, COVID. So now it's gotta be by 11 o'clock at night.
So yeah, it's very, very amazing the background and career that you have and what you're doing and how you got there. So can you tell everybody a little bit how you and I first met?
Very little. I was young.
Yes.
I was very young. So young.
Almost as young as possible.
Yes. I actually, you could probably tell me more about how we first met than I could.
Yes. So it's probably a good time to drop the pretense at this point. As people may have already jumped to the conclusion, this is my sister.
We don't look anything alike.
We look very, very, very dissimilar on a lot of key points there. So
no one will know.
They would have never figured it out had we.
You should have said like
dropped the pretense.
We're twins.
Yes. So the genesis of this podcast, and you know, I do want to thank you for being on this and launching the second season and really the new direction that the podcast is going, was a discussion that we had over at our folks' house. Mm-hmm. And you know, as that can be, there's, you know, we start talking and sometimes we're talking to each other and sometimes we're talking at each other. And most of the time it's just, you know, the people in the room talking to hear themselves talk. But I think,
yeah, that's our family.
Yes.
Do we really want to go into that or something else?
Yeah, that dynamic where we grew up with a complete inability to communicate or have a conversation in a group.
Is that why we do what we do, to like coach people in communication and persuasion and influence, because we just couldn't?
Well, it's like the person who grew up in poverty who goes on to help people with money management. They never had it in their life, so now they want to help others in the same position.
We're all just working out our own trauma.
Yeah, working it through, and you and I have decided to get a pair of podcasts in order to work this through in the public airways. But you know, a little bit, you know, we were talking a little bit about gender dynamic. I think it actually started with a conversation about Susan B. Anthony dollars.
That's right.
And you and I had a little difference of opinion, and you know, on, you know, I'm not saying you're a bit conspiratorial, but I will mark things up to incompetence before I assume malice.
That's even better.
But particularly in regards to the federal government. So, you know, maybe you could start with that conversation with the Sacagawea dollars and how that conversation started.
So I think this was that I was trying to pay for something with a gold $1 coin.
Correct. Which looks exactly like you got it from Chuck E. Cheese.
Right. And they didn't want to accept it because they were completely confused. And it was interesting, right? That features Lady Liberty. Sacagawea dollar, the Susan B. Anthony coin. The observation, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. I think that it's just simply an observation at this point that all of our currency.
I believe what you said was, well, there's some horrible feedback there, but I believe what you said was that legal tender with a woman's image on it is designed to be deliberately confusing.
I think. Women featured on our currency is confusing and obscure, not like on the $5 bill or the $1 bill, right? And that feels to me like an observation that says something, right? It literally is, what do we value as an organization or as a company or as a country? What do we value? I don't know that it's the history and influence of women, simply because we aren't, there's no artifact of that. All of the women that are change agents that have been identified for currency, they're obscure, they're in like specialized rotation. To me, it just is an interesting observation.
So, you know, obviously there was, a move to place Harriet Tubman on the, was it on the 20?
Mm-hmm.
And that was...
No, I think it was a $10 bill. It's a $10 bill. Think about that. The $10 bill. How many ATMs have you gone to where you could get a $10 bill? Zero. When was the last time you used a $10 bill? Almost never.
Are you sure it wasn't on the 20?
I'm fairly certain it was a $10 bill. But your listeners will correct me, and I am open to feedback.
Yes, I'm sure you will get almost a dozen letters of correction from my small but loyal listener base. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, what money looks like, you know, the, you know, if you go back, you know, the usage of money, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40,000 years ago, whatever that was, even back where, you know, it was shells and rocks or ingots. You know, that does tell you a lot about a country when you look at what the money looks like, you know, there's the stories of in the UK when they went from paper, when they went from coin to paper money, you know, and, you know, the idea that, you know, there was an inherent value in coin and paper seemed worthless. So in order to make it worth more money, they, or to convince people it was worth something, they ended up putting the queen on it. You know,
there we go. Like, it's that this is worth something because, and I think sometimes we use that in the reverse.
So, you know, that's where it started. And then it veered into some issues that you had, noticed, observed, been aware of, even worked to try to overcome from a structural basis. So there, you know,
what you're referring to is that I think daylight savings time is part of the patriarchy.
That was it. That was it. I could not think of exactly when the tinfoil hat came out, but it was when you tied, which I sat aghast for a while, not realizing that you perhaps were serious with this. That the patriarchy had developed daylight savings time and the workday in general to be structurally discriminate towards one gender. Now, you have your opportunity here to either double down on obviously a well thought out position or maybe let's just say clarify it.
As it will not be a shock to your listenership at this point, I'm not married. and I mean, I've got tickets to the Indigo Girls concert on Monday.
Okay.
But here's the thing. I think that here was my point, right? The modern workday has to be updated for what is next. There's a lot that has been driven currently, standard business hours, the way in which we operate with, particularly in corporate organizations around a level of machismo equals performance. So the more you spend your life here, that means you're committed and that must mean that you're performing. That has to change. I think we realize, particularly with, you know, over the last 18 months, especially, when you have to reframe your life around all things in your life, you look at work differently. For instance, here's a perfect example, right? An 8-to-5 office job. Does the work in that office need to happen from 8 to 5? Or is it better for that to happen from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.? Is it better for the talent pool that you're trying to attract, for instance? Because I always look through the lens of talent management. Are you trying to attract a talent pool that needs to take their kids to school in the morning? School doesn't start till 8:30. So what do you do, right? Do things need to be, or can you have jobs that are permanently work from home versus you need to be in an office because your butt in a seat equals performance? I just think we need to challenge the conventions of performance and what is standard working or standard operating procedure that may just simply be, and a lot of companies talk about innovation, but they're not innovating their workplace standards or culture. Now there's the other end of the spectrum here too, right? Like a Netflix where there's no vacation days and your vacation days are unlimited, right? I think that's challenging convention in a way that may have been a little bit too much.
Yeah, but doesn't unlimited vacation days you know, put an undue burden on people. Isn't it almost like, you know, planting a $20 bill on the floor behind the cash register to see if somebody will pick it up?
That's right. I absolutely agree. I mean, I think that's the extreme end of toxicity. The other extreme is you get 5 sick days, you get 2 weeks vacation, and by God, your butt better be in that seat by 7:55 a.m. and it's not leaving until 5:01. And I think those are polar opposites of sort of a toxicity of workplace. Well, actually, no, I should say the other end of that is you need to work from the moment your eyes open to the moment your eyes close. And I don't care what you're doing or what your other obligations are or what fills your tank, that email, that phone call comes first. That's the other end, I think.
And there's a lot to unpack in that. And I don't know if I'm going to have a chance to go through all of it. But I want to remind everyone that we are here with Christy Jones, Manager of Leadership Development for the Meyer Corporation, based right here in West Michigan. We're going to take a real quick break and more to come as we continue the TriCast. You know, when you talk about remote work and since 2005, from 2005 to really up until last year, I had a broad regional territory that I managed for different auto groups. You know, I was always somewhere. Had a little bit of it was slid over into another time zone, so that kind of created some chaos. But what I noticed was the difference between being at a store level position and being at a regional position was my day never had a beginning or an end. You know, it was not unusual for, you know, the early morning risers in Massachusetts to shoot me an email at 5:00 in the morning. Now, when am I responsible to reply? At what point am I an unresponsive employee or an unresponsive, you know, manager if I don't reply to that for 3 hours? You know, on the other side of it, you know, store hours, you know, were to 9:00 at night. You know, my day at the store level was, you know, I was scheduled to work at 6:00 and then I was off at 6:00 and had a, you know, occasionally would get a phone call after, but, you know, not unusual to get a phone call 8:30, 9:00, you know, in the summer, you know, conceivably at 10:00. And, you know, when you take a look at these things that were supposed to give us, you know, freedom and quality of life and work remote, and you can be anywhere you want, you're always tethered. And it was that sense of tethering that actually had me go back into a store at one point, because I was never disconnected. From the moment I got up till, you know, 10:30 at night, conceivably there was someone somewhere in those, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 stores who was reaching out to me, and I had to re-engage with my work, and there was no off work Troy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was working the whole day.
So, I mean, I get it. I mean, we pre-pandemic, our stores closed one day a year. That's Christmas Day. And I remember the year that I got an email from an HR generalist on Christmas Day. We're closed one day a year. Our stores at that point were open 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
My store directors, primarily the leaders that I work with, they're responsible for 400 lives, 24/7, 364. And they feel it. And if we are, there's two things, right? One, it says the system is stacked for you never to be caught up, right? It's stacked that way. And I get that from a business perspective. My livelihood depended on a small business making a profit. I get it. And I had two babies at the time that is never lost on me. But if your business fundamentally is structured in a way your team can never really win, right? And I mean really win in that there's a start and an end that we can celebrate, or we celebrate something, but, right? It's sort of the verbal erasers that I see a lot of leaders using. You know, gosh, we did this great thing, and but there's so much more that we've got to do. And here's, let's go into a postmortem on this project or this deliverable. And you instantly see the energy of the team and feel the energy of the team like, well, shit, I had like 3 milliseconds of achievement that I could feel, or recognition that I could feel for the 3 months, 3 years, 3 weeks of work. That's not okay. That's not how the human spirit operates in the world.
Well, do you think when that happens, and you know, I of course I grew up in a culture of hero to zero. You know, you close down on the 31st of the month. You had all your business in by, you know, noon on the first, and you know, at 12:01 it was, hey, we're heroes, we did it, and now we're zeros. And do you think that is created by people in those middle level management because they think it's motivating, or do you think it's a response from the pressure they're getting from senior management? I guess I'm asking, where do you think it's starting? Is it starting in that mid to senior, or is it starting in the senior to executive level?
So I'll answer that question.
Well, thank you.
The more
that will make this a much, much better podcast, rather than you saying, on advice of my attorney.
No, sadly, my attorney's not here.
Thank goodness.
So, because he would have a whole other perspective on this. But so here's what I'll say. The reason that is so damaging is because it's driven out of fear, wherever it comes from in an organization, mid-level managers or C-suite or anywhere in between, it's fear. I'm going to lose something. I'm going to be shamed. I'm going to be on a bottom of a list as opposed to the top. It triggers all of those things that are driving the worst of people, right? What do you do when you're afraid? You either fight, flee, or you fold, right? So you give up, or you start to get really aggressive with your team because you're going to fight, or you flee. And I bet you've seen this, particularly in your business, where the leader just becomes absent when things are bad because they just, it's overwhelming anxiety, shame, et cetera.
And I have seen that where, you know, you fight, you flee, and freeze is the other one more than fold, is you just, you stay in one place, don't make any decisions, don't do anything. And you can get that level of indecisiveness. You know, that to me, to work in an indecisive environment is probably my little, you know, private hell loop, where you have these long feedback loops. And I wanted to address something about the work schedule and when people should be there. I've always looked at a business has to be open when their customers are open. Mm-hmm. You know, as you know, I go through and I see a business is open from 10 to 6. Well, I go to work before 10 o'clock and I get after, you know, I get off of work after 6 o'clock, you know, and then you have that one building or that one spot in the strip mall that, you know, constantly has a rotating door of businesses that continue to go in there and fail, you know, open 10 to 6, alternating Thursdays. Sometimes they're closed Monday, sometimes they're not. So I think there's something to be considered with being open when your customers are open. But I think the other side of it is, you know, how far out does that feedback loop get when you have 15 different employees on 15 different schedules. You know, is there something to be said for, you know, in order for us to have a quality of life, and for me, that's huge, you know, do I have to wait because my schedule is from 6 a.m. to noon, but the person I need feedback from or require something from, you know, their schedule is from, you know, 10 to 7. So what are your thoughts on those two items? Being open when your customers are open, but also, you know, reducing, you know, the length of time on these feedback loops, particularly with decision makers.
So it's just like European cigarettes on the side, they say, this will, smoking causes wrinkles and premature aging. So I'm going to go right to the biggest trigger, which is vanity, right? So if there's anything that's going to, like, if you tell me I'm going to get lung cancer, I don't see those. If you tell me I'm going to age prematurely, I might have a second thought. So
now, have you ever had a European cigarette?
Yes.
Because I think almost immediately upon having one European cigarette, I had, what is it, wrinkles and early aging?
You'll age prematurely, yeah.
Yes, it was just a little harsher than the worst skunk weed I had in college. Back to the point.
So, vanity. Nail salons that are open Sundays, they get the biggest tips for their technicians. You wanna know why? People like me. My Saturdays, I've got stuff with my kids. Monday through Friday, I've got my job. If you're open on a Sunday, I'm gonna make my appointment. They're packed full of people and they get better tips, right? Because this is my time. So yes, being open when your customers, and not just your customers, but the customers you really want. It depends on who truly is your customer. I think a lot of businesses, especially small businesses, they don't understand who their customer is.
But doesn't
that's a whole other story though.
Doesn't that put the idea of operating a business with a core principle of providing quality of life to your employees, doesn't that create a conflict if your one core value is we're going to be open for the customers we want when they're open, and a secondary core value of we're going to make sure that our people have a good quality of life? You know, the nail salon is a great example of, you know, now we're going to require people to work on Sunday, which is a terrible day to go into work. Or it's, Saturday morning.
Well, is it though? Because if you are the stay-at-home parent Monday through Friday, and the only time that you get free childcare is when the spouse is open Saturday and Sunday, Saturday and Sundays are awesome days to work. So I think this is where people aren't, from a leadership standpoint, they aren't thinking about how do I match the need of my customer and the need of my business with the right talent. And when you start to kind of go down that rabbit hole of questioning, you start to understand maybe the convention that I was thinking of, or sometimes just the assumption that everyone's life is like my life. When we start to challenge that, you then start to make a really smart match in the talent that you employ and the need of your customer. That doesn't always happen. And that is, I know that is like pie, particularly in the talent scenarios that we have today. I don't think it's far-fetched or pie in the sky, but I do think it is sort of idyllic and we've got to find a middle ground in many businesses. But if you are thinking as an owner, as a leader, how do I match what my customer needs most and what my business needs most? And then how do I need to think differently because of that? And I don't know that if a lot of, I don't know enough leaders are thinking like that, right? So how do I, as a leader, need to think differently? How do I need to look at this problem differently? And that involves thought partnership and bringing in other perspectives kind of a wide or wider lens on the world. But, you know, and we can go into sort of the mental models of this, of growth mindset versus fixed mindset. That's why a fixed mindset is so dangerous to a company, because it just breeds this sense of it has to be this way because it's been this way.
Yeah, it has always been, you know, my observation that a company.
Oh, wait a minute, before you say that.
Okay.
I told you I was going to answer the question, and now I've forgotten. Oh, where does that come from? Who drives the fear and the anxiety of that?
Yes.
Public companies, fear of short-term dips, even for long-term gain. Private companies, fear of the response of the private holders or private owners. That is a cloud of disappointment that makes people feel gross inside. There's my answer.
Okay, good answer. You know, it is this, you know, do you operate from fear?
The more I drink, the better I get.
But you know, and these phrases have been thrown around, you know, where you have, you know, the idea of scarcity thinking or abundance thinking, operating out of fear, operating out of courage, infinite player versus finite player. Mm-hmm. And I think that the struggle is that when you look at the three, which are told, you know, we're told are positive, be an infinite thinker, operate out of courage, think in terms of abundance. The problem with those is the negative effects are so fast. You know, when you go and think about, okay,
are you talking about like the acute pain of that thinking?
I think you have that J curve, where when you get away from a traditional thinking of these are our competitors, we're going to outwork them, we're going to out discount them, we're going to out market them, we're going to, you know, what can we do for a short term? You know, how can we get these short term, these 30 day boosts? You know, the old saying was long term is just a string of short terms, when that's actually the furthest thing from the truth. Mm-hmm. And you know, in my experience, there's always been that pressure on, you know, me in particular in my career, where I'm taking a look at the long view. And yes, from a short-term perspective, get in there and micromanage the team. I know what happens to a team that gets micromanaged. And I have put myself in jeopardy. I have created conflict because I've resisted doing that for the good of the company. Now, in a lot of cases, I've been very lucky and I've had the opportunity to do it when places were in really bad shape. When I went into a broken store, hey, Troy, no one's figured this thing out for 5 years. We're going to leave you the heck alone. It's when you go into a good store, when you go into a good operation and want to take it to great, that initial drop of, see, I told you this wouldn't work, happens.
This is why the essential, well, this is why I think the leaders that will take us truly into the future can never be the one trick pony. I'm a turnaround guy. Great. Like, be that turnaround guy. But if you can't also be a good to great leader, it doesn't do me much good in a business, right? Because I actually have to have teams that suck in order for you to be bringing your full potential. I don't want that, right? So exactly what you're saying. And I think we're just sort of uniquely positioned because of our life, how we grew up, right? That there's situational adaptability that the leaders of the future must have to say, if I stand in observation of how this team and how this business is operating, what does it need of me? Do I need to micromanage because this is a turnaround situation? Or do I need to be thoughtful in building trust in this particular team that maybe has tweaking, not changing, that needs to happen? Or do I need to cast really a dramatically different vision for this team so that they're invited to a future they want to be a part of? You know, I think that situational adaptability component is something that's often missed in leadership because you, I mean, let's face it, right? What do you interview for? You interview for everything you did. If we look at the attributes of someone and say, gosh, no matter what you were faced with, you could adapt quickly. You could influence others in a way that drove them to their best, not necessarily your greatest reward, but their best. Now we're talking, right? Because you can step into any situation and respond,
but not react. When you look at, you know, the basis of, you know, you're kind of talking about servant leadership, you know, doing what's best for the team, having the team become better, having it move forward, you know. I'd love to get your input, your view on that. But I think right now is a great time for us to go ahead and wrap up part one. Thank you to everyone who tuned in, who downloaded, who picked up on this podcast. Very excited about this second season. It's all dependent on you, the listener. Go ahead, like, share, subscribe, tell your friends about it, and reach out to me. I really want this to be a community. You can contact me through the listing platform there, either in comments or access to my email address, or you can look me up on LinkedIn. So until next time, I do look forward to hearing from you, and hopefully you tune in as we start the second segment of this great talk we're having with Christy Jones.
Russian
is it a relevant leprechaun?
What does it say?
I can't read it.
Michigan's original something.
Yeah, but I think that's a leprechaun.
It does have a leprechaun vibe, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Give me a second since you're going to do this.
Oh, Michigan's original since 1866.
And so then everybody dressed like a leprechaun back then?
Sounds like a really wonderful world, but...
Wait. What year was that? 1866?
1866.
So 1 year after the Civil War, somebody decided that they needed a very strange golden ginger ale.
And they're like, ginger ale, you know what we need? What's the most ginger thing that can happen?
A leprechaun?